Welcome back to another episode of Anarcho Book Club. So today we're going to cover at least chapters 3 and 4 of part 1, and we might get into part 2 as well, but let's just start with chapter 3. And chapter 3 is called Return. In the first section of chapter 3 is Refusal of the Return. And so in this section, Campbell points out, a few things actually about the hero. And so the hero has accomplished his or her goal of whatever it is, rescuing the princess, or finding a source of power, and or in the case of the Buddha, achieving a sort of wisdom or enlightenment. And the hero now must return to his people or her people and share this wisdom or share this power or share this this gift that has been achieved. And for instance, in the Sigurd legend, Sigurd rescues Brunhild, and he doesn't refuse the return. He returns valiantly and makes her his queen and so on and so forth, and brings the riches that he has gained as well, and shares them with his people. In fact, this is one thing that I wanted to sort of point out. Something different about the Teutonic myths that I see from other myths, and it's not really, it's kind of a subtle difference. It's not really a big difference at all, but they, in the Teutonic society, or the what you might think of as the Scandinavian society, the northern myths, the ring giver was a it was kind of a monolithic idea throughout Finnish society and Swedish, Danish, all of the different societies of the north. The ring giver was the great leader, the hero. Maybe I should flesh that out a little bit more, because the ring giver was generally one of the most powerful men or women, and there were at least one or two cases where it was a woman as well. The ring giver was the person who had achieved greatest success in his or her society, be it, and with the Vikings, or as what we think of as the Vikings, with the Icelanders and the Danish, that generally was something like, they were great traders. They were able to sail to far reaches of the world and trade for valuables and bring them back to society. And later in Nordic history, it sort of became a, they went out and they, in many cases, they went out to trade and were met with resistance, and eventually they became something like marauders, or as they were called, Vikings, or as they are called now, Vikings. And Viking is a really interesting word too. We won't get too much into it, but to go a Viking was it was a a term that they used to say, I'm going out to raid. I'm going to raid these places. And normally, at least in the histories that I've read so far, and I've read quite a bit of like Icelandic history and Danish history, the Book of Danish Kings and so on. In their histories, most of the time it started out, they were just going out to trade. They were met with some sort of resistance, and in their honor society, because their society held honor to be a very high high moral standard, which makes sense, because in something that's near anarchy, which is what their society was, something that is, especially the Icelanders, in fact, Murray Rothbard and even J.R.R. Tolkien have both written papers and suggested that for the first couple of hundred years in Iceland, it was essentially a structured society, but it was a, they were without a king. They were without any sort of central governance. They were essentially an anarchic society. And that lasted for generations. But eventually, of course, they were betrayed by, well, by the author of the younger Edda, the, what, the, oh, what was his name? It's been so long since I've read it. Well, anyway, the younger Edda, the more story-like Edda, it, as opposed to the Poetic Edda, which is an older collection. But, I've got to look it up. I can't remember, which is just pitiful, but younger Edda, because I studied this for years. I don't understand how I... Snorri Sturluson, yes, that's it. And he eventually betrayed the Icelanders and brought the king of Denmark to conquer them. In a way, in a sense, anyway. But he was more of a Loki character, really. And that's another thing. So a lot of the Icelanders, and I don't mean to get into this too much, but the Icelanders, the Danes, the Swedes, they had a sort of relationship to their... excuse me, to their religion, that, well, they had a sort of relationship that you don't see throughout the rest of the histories and mythologies, because, for instance, and you can kind of see this in the History Channel TV show Vikings, different tribes or different groups, different clans would have a connection to different gods. Thor was the big one. He was in the Viking Age, anyway. He was one of the ones that really inspired a lot, because he was sort of the supreme hero. And that's something that you should understand, is that these myths, it may not be that the progenitors of the myths truly believe that, say, Thor still exists, or Thor still is here on Earth, although I think they did for the most part. But it doesn't mean that so much as... because that's not the point. The point isn't that there is Thor and there is Odin. The point is that these are things that we as a society, if we are of the Nordic societies, we as a society hold these things. Let's just look at the historical documents of the U.S. We hold these things to be self-evident, as it were. That we have... there's a characteristic to our society that is of Thor. There is a characteristic of our society that is of Odin and of Loki. Snorri Sturluson was more of a Loki-like character. He was involved heavily in politics. He was always seeking fame for himself. He would not have been a ring giver. And to get back to that, the ring giver was the most successful, either in the early times, trader or merchant. And it was expected of this ring giver. It wasn't... there was no real law, so to speak. Although later there was, but there was no real law, so to speak, that said the most successful must sort of have a mutual aid relationship with those around him. But it would be considered dishonorable if he went off, gained great resources, came back, and then hoarded them. Hoarding of resources made you like the dragon, which was the ultimate evil in Nordic society. Or Teutonic. I'm going to use the Teutonic society from now on, because that is actually a more all-encompassing term. But just think Iceland, Sweden, Denmark, even Finland, for that matter, even though they're a little bit apart, set apart from it. But in Teutonic society, if you had great wealth, you were expected to share that wealth. And not in sort of a way where anyone would come knocking at your door and demand that you share the wealth, but more if you didn't share the wealth that you gained going abroad, then you were looked at dishonorably. People would, and you would eventually lose that wealth, in fact, because people wouldn't trade with you, people wouldn't associate with you. You would be shunned from society. No one would come with, you know, torches and pitchforks and burn down your house. No one would come and steal your wealth. No one would come and do anything like that. But they would make sure, by shunning you and socially isolating you, that you would not have a place in their society. And one could almost say that that is a peaceful way of resolving a bad actor in society. It was shunning. Now later, it did become law. It became codified in law all over the Teutonic world. But that one of the things that I see, and I've kind of noticed throughout history, and it doesn't matter what, if it's Teutonic or if it's, you know, Egyptian or Greek or whatever it is. One of the things I've noticed is the moment that you must begin making laws is the moment that you know that your society is beginning to break apart, little by little. In the founding of the United States, there was a body of law, and it was a simple body of law. It was just a couple of documents. And now each state and each city had their own body of laws, but still they were all fairly simple. But as society moved forward, or as time marched forward, I should say, things would happen. Social pressure would not work as well anymore, and so they would introduce new laws. And then they would use the force of government to enforce these laws. And eventually we came to the point where we are today, where, let's just say, tax law, for instance. You would fill entire rooms with the books that hold all the tax laws in the United States. Just the federal tax laws, mind you. And then you move on to state and local tax laws, and you would fill entire buildings with the books just for these laws, if they were printed. It's kind of insane. That's how society has progressed. And that's how you know that, like, current day society is beginning to break down. Or actually, from my opinion, and maybe this is just the, I don't know if you would call it a boomer opinion, but from my opinion, from where I sit or stand, it looks like we're already past the point of the beginning of the breakdown. It has progressed, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that's something that Teutonic mythology has shown us. And this is kind of going off on a tangent, but it's something I thought about the first time I read this, and the second time I read this, I thought about the same thing. And I think the Teutonic myths, I gravitate towards them so much because I studied them so much. But one of their the first poem in the Elder Edda, in the Codex Regis, is called the Völuspá. And in that book, in that poem, it lays out history perfectly, in my opinion. Society is created. It's a joyous thing. It's a terrible thing at the same time. Society rises up, and you have the Council of the Gods, which can represent... Each of the gods represents a different type of person in the society. But the Council of the Gods, you have 12, and they identify 12 characteristics of humans, and then embodied them in a god, or in an Aesir, because it wasn't until later that they were thought of as gods. In fact, through my research, I did find that each of the gods could be tracked back to an actual person, at least through the verbal telling of the stories. So, and many of them actually came from, like, the Odin character is actually a character sort of borrowed from the early Russian, or at least the Russian area, the Slavic traditions. And And in fact, and this is just another side note, but I'm easily sidetracked by my own thoughts. In fact, I even read a few studies that suggested that perhaps the whole of Teutonic society came from Russia, which is an interesting idea. It was a migration out of Russia, away from whatever it was there that was going on, and I never really found out what that might be, but they migrated over and started their own society, and it was a interesting time. But the Voluspá lays that out very, very well. But then the progression goes, and it starts with the burning of the witch. The downfall begins with the burning of the witch. And I think that signifies the perhaps first blood. The same in biblical mythology, the Cain killing Abel. Its first blood is drawn. And that's the beginning of the downfall. And perhaps you could even line that up with the making of the first law enforced by a group of people who call themselves government or the leaders or whatever, what have you. And then it progresses from there. And eventually, it comes to a head and the great dragon rises up and the great battle commences. And the 12 personalities of society, the 12 gods of society, they do battle with them. But in Teutonic myth, the ending is not quite so happy. Oh, I missed one part. At one point, there comes a turning point when things really turn for the worse, because everything progresses and, you know, everything's okay. But then at one point, the god Baldur the White, as he's called, because he's supposed to signify everything that is good about society, everything that is pure, everything that is washed clean. He's killed. He's killed by Loki. But by Loki, not by Loki's hand. And that's important, in my opinion. Because he's killed by Loki whispering to the blind god Hoth to throw something at Baldur. Because Baldur would walk through and to show how resilient he was to the slings and arrows, the things that anyone could throw at him, he could resist it. Except there's one thing, there's always one thing that Baldur cannot resist, and that is, in this case, the holly leaf. And Loki gives Hoth the holly leaf and says, throw this at him. And he's a devious god, you see, Loki. Hoth isn't. He's a blind god. He great wisdom and so on. But so he does. And kills Baldur. Baldur's dead now. And that signifies the death of goodness. All that is good in society. All that is righteous. And this is when the great fall begins. And it progresses further from this, and brother fighting brother, axe age, sword age, you know, all these things begin to happen. Till it comes to a head, the great dragon rises, the wolf Fenrir does battle with the gods, and that signifies the end of an age, the end of society. But then at the very end of the poem, society is reborn, and this is what makes me think this is a telling of the progression of society, because society always will rise up and then fall down, and it ends in fire every time. It seems to, if you think about it, throughout history, every great society falls into chaos, and that's what this is. But then it'll rise up again, and the whole cycle begins again, and that's the ring cycle, in a sense. And I know this really kind of comes apart but this is the return of the hero could signify this turning point. If the hero refuses to return, the hero is one that comes to prolong the golden age, to prolong the age of goodness, the age of Baldur. But if he comes back, and this is part of the problem, if he comes back and the people refuse him, then that marks the end. That marks the death of Baldur. That marks the beginning of the Ragnarok in Teutonic mythology. That marks when society will be coming to an end. And those that survive, there will only be a few. And you see this in the Christian mythology as well. Because it talks about in Revelation, the great end of society. And at one point, according to Christian mythology, Jesus will come back. And if you refuse him, and Jesus is also Baldur. He is the significant character. He is the character that signifies all that is good, all that is right, righteous, I should say. All that makes society a great and wonderful thing. All that makes us all live in some sort of peace, in some sort of harmony. And if he comes back, which could be anything, it could be a preacher standing on the corner saying, the end is nigh if you don't turn away from your wicked ways or what have you. And what could those wicked ways be? Well, perhaps it's the ring giver that doesn't give out rings. Perhaps it's the man or woman who owns a great amount of wealth and does not help his or her fellow man. It could be a number of things. But and I think the refusal of the call, of the return, is the people refusing the return. Although in other mythologies, Campbell points out that it is actually like, for instance, in the, what's it called? It's the Book of Saints. I forget what it's called. But in, about the Christian saints, the Catholic saints, sometimes, the hero already knows they will refuse, and he refuses to return. He chooses to die instead of return and live in eternal glory with God, as it were. And this is significant because at that point you know society has progressed too far along. By progressed, I mean, of course, progressed towards its own destruction. Too far. It has gone on too long. And now the hero won't even return. The hero decides it's too late. And you can see that again. Now, see, the Bible, all of the books in the Bible, they each have different little pictures. And I think part of what makes the Bible so great as a piece of literature in society, in all of society, regardless, is that it was written in a way that encapsulates everything in society. I mean, I think the Poetic Edda, the Codex Regis, whatever you want to call it, it does a really good job as well, but it takes a lot more thought to really extract what this is, what the meaning out of it. Whereas the Bible, it lays it out plainly. Very, very plainly. If you read through the Bible front to back, I think 66 individual books within it, if you read it front to back, you will see laid out the progression of society in every book. Or at least snapshots of a particular segment of the progression. And so many times there is this refusal of the return, which I think is just, well, it's fascinating to me, to be honest with you. But then that brings us to the Magic Flight. And it's a monolithic, or a, as Campbell says, a monomythic feature of the hero journey. Whenever the hero does choose to journey back, he thinks that there is some portion of society that will accept the gifts that he brings, be it wisdom, or be it wealth, or be it his newfound bride. When he does decide, normally he has offended one of the gods or goddesses or the king or a monster of some sort, a great beast. Or he has the support of the great beast or the monster or the king or the goddesses or whatever, what have you. And they either the god or goddess or whatever it is, they somehow spirit him back to his world. I think of what's it called? I think of the journey. Oh, what was it called? You see, this is unedited. You can tell because this is how my memory works. Sometimes I remember the different myths, the different fairy tales, or whatever it is. Sometimes I don't. I don't remember what they're called. But there's a myth in Old English fairy tale, or I guess it's a fairy tale in the English tradition, where I thought I had it there. Anyway, there's a myth that a man falls asleep under a tree, in which you should know, if you read any fairy tales at all, you should know that that is significant, and you ought not to fall asleep under a tree. I'm sorry, it wasn't a man, it was a young maiden, as it were. She fell asleep under a tree, and she spirited away to the underworld, or to the fairyland, anyway. And her significant other comes. I'm not sure if it was just her lover or her husband. I think it was her husband, in fact. He comes and finds that she's gone. And he finds his way to fairyland. The fairy queen, who is the goddess of the dead. She's the one who protects the dead. She invites him to, she spirits him away to her kingdom. And he finds his beloved there. And there's a whole journey there. But whenever it's time, whenever he achieves the goal of finding her and wants to take her back, at that point, that is the point in the myth where either the goddess or god will oppose him or help him. And in this case, if my memory serves me well, the fairy queen helps and spirits him and his dearly beloved back to the world of man, back to the what we would call the real world. And that is the magic flight. That is the section of the journey that is the magic flight. And this happens throughout myth, throughout all of myth. I think Campbell talks about Jason who stole the golden fleece, and he has to evade the all of the attacks by the different gods on his way back. And Campbell says, in fact, and I actually bookmarked this, if the monomyth is to fulfill its promise of inspiring humanity to better itself, not human failure or superhuman success should be its focus, but human success is what we shall have to be shown. And I marked that because it's a psychological truth, I think. It's a truth that you can find in the human psyche, that it's not so much, it's not so much your individual success, your own heroic success against the all those that might oppose you. It's the success that you bring to your society. And the moment you begin focusing on your own individual success, although that can be good, it can be motivating, and I don't deny that, but the moment that you lose sight of the success of your society around you for the sake of your own success is the moment that Balder is dead. That is the moment in which Balder dies, and the end, the Ragnarok, hastens to you in your society. And maybe you'll live out your life just fine. And you won't have to be met with a great crash. But in the end, what you have done is a detriment to your society. And I think this is, whenever I look out on and I see in the news the cries against the 1%. I know this is kind of an old thing now, but because it's moved on, they call them something different. But in my mind, it's still the cries against the 1%, because it's the 1% who they take and take and take for themselves. They should be the great ring givers who give freely to their society. And there are those who argue that, well, of course they do. They create all these goods for us to consume. But the greater story is society still seems to be coming apart at the seams. So what they're doing is not, in fact, what society needs. They are supposed to be the ones who are the ring givers, the ones who have achieved some sort of greatness, and they can spread this greatness out with the rest of society. But in fact, they're like dragons. They hoard, they build up their power, and anyone that comes near them, they unleash a fiery hell upon. Anyone that comes near them may suffer the poison claw, the poison tooth of the dragon. And what society cries out for whenever they cry out against the 1%ers, the 1%, or the 0.1% now, is I think what Bernie Sanders and his lot are talking about. Those that cry out against them, they cry out for a hero. They cry out for Sigurd to go out and slay the dragon. They cry out for Beowulf to come and slay this monster who hoards for himself. And I'm not going to make a moral judgment whether that is right or whether that is wrong. I don't think it's my place to make the moral judgment, because I don't think it is right, and I don't think it is wrong, either. I think it simply is. It's the natural progression of the myth, because you know what? We are all living within a myth. Everything we do contributes to the myth. The myth is a reflexive tool. It's something we look back upon, and then we must realize that it reflects upon today's society, on today's time. And it's bigger than us because it lasts longer than our lifespan. Our lifespan may number 80, 90, 100 years, maybe, if you're lucky. But the myth expands, or it encompasses, I should say, a period of 100, or a couple of 100 years, maybe 300, 400, 500 years. U.S. supremacy has only been a thing for 100 years, perhaps. If that. No, not even that. I'd argue that it didn't start until after they seized power after World War II. But it's less than 100 years, and it's already coming apart at the seams. But if you think of the U.S. society as a whole, it stretches back to the 1600s. Though it wasn't a monolithic state at that point, it was simply colonies from different countries. But I would argue that it goes all the way back to that time. So let's say 400 years. It's made it 400 years. The society of the adventurer who came across, the refugee, the society of the immigrant, But you can already see a hastening towards the end. You can already see it. In fact, you can see it 100 years ago. Before the war. Before First Blood. Though First Blood came in the very beginning. The way I see the U.S. myth, United States myth, the way I personally see it, is probably around the Civil War time. That was whenever First Blood was drawn. Excuse my phone. People are just... Sorry about that. You probably heard the little dinging in the background. But society... I would say probably around Civil War times, because that's whenever the U.S. government began to rapidly expand power. And I don't see that as an evil in and of itself. I see it as a symptom of an evil growing. Because around... Good grief. People need to quit. Sorry about this. This my phone seems to be... There we go. So... Society became, or it began to rapidly devolve, because the government began to expand quickly, and Emma Goldman even cites this in her essay on anarchism. But the faster government expands, that's an indication of the society is rapidly devolving. I think around Civil War times, 1850s, 60s, you know, I know when the Civil War was, but I'm just saying, around that time, so around 1850 or so, you would see people like, I don't think it was J.P. Morgan yet, but Carnegie, yeah, I think J.P. Morgan was actually in that time frame too, but they rose up and they were using law and government power to basically beat down anyone who came near them. And that was First Blood in my mind. First Blood was whenever the first law was made to make sure that only one company got the contract for the railroad that went from one coast to the other, basically. The Continental Railroad. To make sure that one company had all the money funneled to it. And that, well, it was, technically it was a sort of an early conglomerate. We called it a cartel back then, in fact. And today I still call them cartels, even though that seems to take on a different meaning. But they cartelized the markets so that only a handful of companies who are all sort of competing with each other, but not really. They were able to amass the wealth to Carnegie, to Morgan, to anyone you can think of that has become some sort of a great industrial figure in society. And that was First Blood, in my view. I could be wrong, but I think it was. But anyway, let's move on, because we're not going to get through this if we don't. Rescue from Without is the next segment, and this will be a short one because I've kind of covered a lot of this already just because of my side rantings here. But Rescue from Without is whenever the hero is unable or unwilling to leave the place to which he has journeyed. It could be Fairyland or the Underworld or what have you. And he seeks rescue from a god or goddess or from some other fellow warrior, as it were. And he must attain this rescue. And there's a whole journey story to it, but we won't really get into that. I mean, how that would relate to what I've been talking about is perhaps a rescue from... Well, I mean, I think the communists back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and onward, I think they sort of were trying to embody this myth. So they thought the U.S. was under some sort of a Well, you could think of the U.S. as a, the people of the U.S., the working class of the U.S., as heroes who were stuck in an underworld, as it were, and they were trying to come in, infiltrate, as it were, and, or as it was portrayed, anyway, and rescue the working class from without. And that was just pulled right off the top of my head. It may not have any make any sense at all, but that's sort of how I saw it. I saw it as they're trying to embody this segment of the myth, because the worker was the hero in their myth. Let's see. And the crossing of the return threshold is an important point in the story, because it addresses the why would the hero want to return? And there's many reasons. We've already sort of covered them. Maybe to bring back to society. If they return and do not bring back to society their wealth, then they become the dragon. They become the beast themselves that they just defeated. But we have already, of course, covered that. And then you have Master of the Two Worlds. It's this one. Let me pull up my notes here because I've forgotten. This is something that Campbell noted. It's not in every myth, so it's not part of the mono... Well, it sort of is part of the mono myth, because it can be extracted, though it's not emphasized in every myth. But it's the ability of the hero to pass between the two worlds. So, with the Buddha, he has achieved enlightenment, but he can still interact with those that are unenlightened. Or with the Jesus myth, he has died and ascended, but he can still come down to earth and interact with those who have not yet died and ascended to his plane. I highlighted this. Here is the whole myth in a moment. Jesus the guide, the way, the vision, and the companion of the return. Now I realize why I've already explained that. Jesus, he is the guide, the way, the vision. And he is able to come back and guide the saints to heaven. So, and then that brings us to the last section of this chapter, which is freedom to live. And it's the hero's reward. Hold on. Time for a drink of coffee. And Campbell says that the hero has returned from his journey with a connection to the transcendent, the universal, the spiritual. And in doing so, has come to realize that the so-called real world, in quotations, is an illusion. He is therefore, as Campbell writes, able to function in the world without ties to it. And if you can't tell, I'm reading right now. He is free to live because he has lived true freedom. And this is the point I wanted to get to, actually. With all my little side notes, this is the point I wanted to get to in this. Because this pertains to anarchists more than anything else, I think, that we've discussed. And I may have even hinted at this. But until I reread the book, I forgot that there is actually a whole section. And it is a very brief, momentary section in the book. But in this section, Campbell is pointing out that whenever you have achieved the enlightenment as the Buddha, or achieved death and life after death as Jesus, whenever you have achieved the great feat, like Sigurd who slays the dragon, or defeats the scheming of Odin. Not obviously not defeating Odin in the process, but whenever you've achieved this, you realize what freedom is. Freedom does not mean that you can just do whatever you want, and you know, you can't just go out and live a lavish lifestyle however you want. Although that is possible. But whenever you achieve the transcendence, You transcend the chains. You transcend the artificial barriers that some organization has placed upon you. You learn to be free. And that is anarchism. Right there. The shortest section of the whole book, from what I can remember. That is anarchism. You have achieved anarchism. Anarchism is an enlightenment of sorts. It's a transcendence in my mind. It is the realization that you are an individual. But it's the realization with all of these other things we've learned along the way. And you can't become an anarchist just by... I mean, so you can say that you are an anarchist. And that's fine. But unless you've learned along the way, which is what I'm trying to do now, with this whole podcast, is learn by reading all the anarchists, the books of wisdom that we need to know what it is to be an anarchist. Unless you've learned along the way and grown in wisdom and taken that heroic journey, as it were, because standing up against power and raising your fist against power, that's one thing. Anyone can do that. Anyone can do that. You can all go march on Wall Street, and you can all camp out there, you can make your signs, and that's great, you know, and that is an element to the myth. But not everyone can transcend their own bonds. Not everyone will reach that spiritual moment where they realize what it is to be an anarchist. It's not defeating the dragon so much. Defeating the dragon is a step in the way on the way to anarchism. And it may not need to be fulfilled the way you think it needs to be fulfilled. That's why you have to lean on your fellow anarchists like Kropotkin or Goldman. We lean on all of them. Bakunin. Who is it? Kropotkin, I think, who is the one who said we are all building upon the shoulders of the anarchists that come before us. Everything that we do, everything, or not just the anarchists, but the people. Everything that we do is a building upon the ones that came before. The desk that I have and the computer I have was created by people, not independently of anyone else. It was created by people who were building upon the technology of what came before. The people that made my desk created it from the knowledge that they gained from those who discovered it before. And that's what we do as anarchists. We have to learn from those that came before. And that's what I'm trying to do with this podcast, is learn everything I can about anarchists, about philosophers, because we're all, in a sense, we all have the capacity to reach that transcendent state and call ourselves anarchists. And you can call yourself an anarchist all along the way, but you'll know whenever you achieve it. Whenever you achieve that state of mind where you realize the state doesn't matter. That Walmart doesn't matter. That Rockefeller doesn't matter. That none of these people really matter in the grand scheme of things. It's you and your local society. You and your local community. And that's why whenever I look out and I see, say, like the different sects of anarchists. I see that and I think that is a step in the right direction. You have the anarcho-communists who just call themselves anarchists sometimes. You have the anarcho-capitalists who also just call themselves the real anarchists. You have the syndicalists. You have all these different sects of anarchism. And they're all trying to find their way to real transcendent anarchism. And I'm not going to claim that I've attained that. I haven't. But I see it now. I see the light there somewhere up in the sky. I see it, and I know what it looks like, I think. But you know, that's another thing I've learned over the years, is you can find it, you can find this, you can think you know what it looks like until you get closer and it becomes something completely different. So, I think I see it. But the freedom to live, that section of this book, and this is partially why I wanted to study this book, and we're only halfway through, I think. Chapter. Yeah, we've got one more chapter in this part, and then we've got part two. But this is one of the main reasons why I wanted to go through this book. Because at one point I remembered it having this in it, and this is the point where you become anarchists. When you realize at the end of your hero journey, because we're all heroes in our own story, when you realize that you have the freedom to live and you understand what that means, you don't just mouth the words, I am an anarchist, I am free, I am whatever I am. You don't mouth those words and go on living in normal society how it is. And you don't just disobey laws because they are laws. That's not why you do it. You realize why you're doing it. Like, I have no reason to disobey the speed limit. Not really. I mean, not right now. Not normally. I have no reason to. So that's not going to change my behavior. I'll go along with it, and that's fine. I have no reason to... let's see, what's another one? No reason to disobey the law to wear my seatbelt. But... Well, it's because it has no real impact on me. However, like I go fishing. I'm mainly... So my diet is mostly a vegetable-based diet. But I do eat fish sometimes, on occasion. It's actually fairly rare. And I do enjoy fishing, because it's a free source of protein for me. And it is almost free. I already own a fishing pole and... all the equipment that I need to catch fish. I will not buy a fishing license. That goes against... And it's because it is inconvenient, of course. It impacts my life significantly. And it also, it's more of a statement for me at that point. Because they also have limits on what you can keep and what you can't keep and so on. And say you caught a bass. If it's less than, I think, 14 inches long, to keep it is a crime. Well, I have caught many 12-inch bass and 11-inch bass that are fully grown. Completely fully grown. And they're getting old, in fact. And they're not going to taste that good whenever you clean them and cook them up. Because they're old. So I'm going to keep... Now, I won't keep little baby fish, because that's ridiculous. It's a waste of time to even catch them. And I do fish for... I don't fish for pleasure, because I think that is wasteful. If you're going to throw a hook into the water and puncture the mouth of an animal... And I know this sounds grotesque, but if you're going to do that, and if you're going to kill and clean and consume this animal, then, first off, in my opinion, if you're not willing to kill and clean and cook an animal... Because it makes you cringe. Like, for instance, a cow. I raised cows once. I had 9 cows on 10 acres. It was my dad's land. And whenever they got old enough to where it was time to slaughter the cows, because that's why you're raising the cows, at least these, I realized At that moment, I realized, and maybe I found some sort of transcendent wisdom at that point, I can't do that. Instead, I sold them, which was the coward's way out, because they're still going to get killed. And I don't know how they're going to get killed, so it may have even been inhumane the way they were killed. But I realized that that was a moment, and my dad always taught me that if you're not willing to, or if you're going to kill an animal, you better eat it. There's no point in killing animals for fun. In fact, that is one of the cruelest things I've ever heard of. Like, whenever we glorify some of these presidents that we've had in the past, like Theodore Roosevelt, who would just go around killing animals for the heck of it. And that's why he formed the Rough Riders, because he wanted to go kill Mexicans just for the heck of it. And then we glorify him as one of the greatest presidents of all time. It's just like, at that point, but anyway, back to the thing. I've learned freedom. And so if I go fishing, I'm not going to buy a fishing license, because that's just a artificial limitation on my innate freedom. But I know why we have fishing licenses, and this goes back to what we began with this episode. It is because society has regressed, or progressed, I should say, because the progression of society is always towards destruction, or at least of organized, regulated society. It's always towards destruction, or maybe just all society, I'm not sure. And to the point where, now, if there weren't licenses, there are people out there who will just catch, they'll dragnet an entire pond, catch all the fish, grind them all up into dog food or whatever, I don't know what it would be, and then they decimate entire ponds. I imagine that's the argument for fishing licenses. For me, I won't do it. I won't break the speed limit, because I have no reason to, but I also won't get a license. And I guess that was all to illustrate, I know it seems kind of petty now that I'm thinking about it, but that was all to illustrate the achievement of freedom. And what freedom means to me, at least, is, or anarchic freedom means to me, is if you're going to do something that goes against the law or the society, the rules of society, it had better benefit you or your society, because I can go fishing and I can break the law by catching whatever I want, and that will clean up the pond, because the pond that I fish in, the ponds that I fish in, they're owned by my grandparents, and they are so underfished that the ponds are actually dying, because the fish are destroying everything in the pond, and eventually it'll kill the fish too. So whenever I go fishing, I'll keep everything as long as it's not a baby fish, and that actually improves upon. And I do it, in fact, I actually go every year, because I decided this years back, I'll go every year because it actually will keep the ponds fishable and lively. It'll keep things growing in these ponds, and also it benefits me, because now I have fish to eat, and that is the one type of meat I think I will eat, the fish or scallops, things like that. Seafood, as it were. And don't ask me why. That's a whole different discussion. But anyway, that is the freedom to live section. And we'll just really quickly, because let me check. I think we're going real long on this one. Yes, we are. Really quickly, let's just hit chapter 4. The keys. Because this is, it's a conclusion to part one. And this is one thing I did kind of highlight something here that I'll summarize it. Campbell does kind of, maybe he even contradicts what I'm saying, but I don't think so. I think I've interpreted it right. He says it's dangerous to interpret myths solely as manifestations of historical events and circumstances. He says, wherever the poetry of myth is interpreted as biography, history, or science, it is killed. The living images become only remote facts of a distant time or sky. When a civilization begins to reinterpret its myths in this way, the life goes out of it. Temples become museums, and the link between the two perspectives is dissolved. That is to say, hopefully I made this clear before, but that is to say, whenever you look at the myth, like the myth of the Völuspá, you don't see that and say that they killed a witch and this is a historical event that happened, let's pinpoint this, this is what it is. No, you see it through a more poetic lens. You see it as a telling of the psychology of society, or the telling of the progression of society on a grand scale. But that doesn't mean that anyone actually did battle with a dragon or a wolf. But those all are ways to interpret. Because whenever you see the monomyth that Campbell is laying out, it is a description. This is a poetic description. The myths all over the world are a poetic description of how a society rises and how a society falls. They are not the, I think it's a three volume set of The Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbons. This is not what myth is. That is a telling of history that may or may not be factual, but it seems like it might be fairly factual. But fact is not what we're seeking here. We're seeking wisdom. We're seeking a philosophical understanding of society. Because we are anarchists, you see. It is a spiritual journey for us. A philosophical journey. And that is the keys to this are... Well, it... Let's see. So I think why he calls it the keys, though, is it's the Roman Catholic Church, the key symbol, the symbolism of the keys. But it is these are the keys to the monomyth. Is the key, or the set of keys, to a, what does he call it, a psycho-spiritual life. It unlocks the doors to the philosophy of myth. The philosophy found within each line of every poem that describes a myth. That is the key, or those are the keys. But I think we've gone on very, very long. What are we at? Over an hour now, and this is unedited. So I'm not editing out any of it. So that wraps up part one. Next week, hopefully, if I have time, we will start part two. We will try to get through chapter one. We might be able to get through chapter two as well. But I'm trying not to go over an hour, especially now that I'm not editing out silences and so on. I hope you enjoyed this. If you did, let me know. I'm at dobbs.town/@harag. You can contact me there, or you can email me at anarchobookclub@riseup.net. If you have any questions, comments, anything, rude remarks are all accepted. And I hope that you enjoyed this, but let me know. So thanks for listening. Bye.